Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello again, everyone. You're very welcome to this week's group chat. Gavin is here. Richard is here. Zara is here. Zara,
hello.
You're back. You're away
I'm
last
back.
Week.
I'm back. I'm alive. I've been very sick. I've actually had an awful dose, to be honest. Lots of people have had a dose, so I don't mind saying it. Loads of people messaged me saying they've had a dose. I got the flu, like the actual flu. I haven't had the actual flu in a long time.
I can't.
Actual flu is rough.
I'm not
actual
sure if
flu
I
is horrific.
Had it twice.
I'm not sure if I actually have ever had the actual flu.
The actual flu.
I'd say you'd know it
joke.
If you did have it.
Yeah. Which is why I don't think I have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was brutal. I got the actual flu and a chest infection. So, I mean, I'm lucky to be alive here today.
Actual flu and a chest infection. And then, of course, you come back and all of our colleagues are speculating, do you think you have pneumonia?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. The whole newsroom thinks I have pneumonia now, which look, we're here anyway.
So if Zara's missing next week, you'll all know why. We're going to start with the cost of living, which is something that obviously we've naturally discussed a lot in the last 2 years they've been doing this, because it's 2 years, of course, this week since the start of the war in Ukraine, which kickstarted a lot of the inflation we've seen in the last couple of years. There's a new word, though, in the lexicon that I hadn't seen until the last couple of days. I think you put this on our running order, Richard. What is a vibe session?
Yes, the vibe session is a term which economists in the States popularized initially, and it is basically the feeling that people, ordinary people in the country, have about the state of the economy, that it's bad, that the cost of living crisis is still biting them, that they don't have as much confidence to spend as much money on things, that they are having to cut back and to save on things. And all of this despite the fact that the key economic indicators that would point to the strength of the economy are moving in the right direction.
So all the headline stuff is all great. The economy is growing. There's more people at work. Earnings are all going up. So on the face of it, you look at it in the abstract, everything should be rosy in the garden.
Yes. And despite that, it really isn't. Now, traditionally around this time of year, we'd actually find that that's when consumer confidence does take a slide. And that has been borne out in the figures recently, because it's that post-Christmas period where people have a lot of new bills, for example. Mm. They've had the expense of Christmas. So January and February are the toughest months generally for households to get through. Mm. It's also potentially why you mightn't have a general election in January or February, because gloomy economically, as well as in the weather and in terms of daylight hours.
For the last three.
Exactly, yeah.
The last three of them were all in February,
there you
which
go.
Is why they all went great for the existing government.
So this is the thing. The vibe session is the fact that the public feels their financial situation has gotten worse over the past year, despite relative improvements in the economy. So this is something which is being felt not just in Ireland, even though we have very, you know, strong indicators that the economy is moving in the right direction, but people are not feeling that and they're having to cut back in many, many different ways.
Which is remarkable timing then, given that, Zara, we also had this week a new cost of living report from Barnardo's. And sometimes you get these reports and you almost sort of see them as par for the course. Some of what they find is dreadful, but that you're not terribly shocked by them. I was really shocked by that headline figure of the volume of parents that are skipping meals so that their kids can eat.
Yes. Yeah,
I was really stunned by this.
Yeah, so this is the Barnardo's food insecurity report, and basically the findings show that around 40% of parents are either going without a meal or they're having a smaller portion in order to feed their children. They also show that a quarter of parents have had to borrow money to feed their children. So one of the things that comes up when you kind of break down the figures and look at it in terms of analysis is the question about whether people had perhaps been surviving on savings for the last little while since the cost of living crisis kicked in. So maybe people did have perhaps a little bit of money possibly left over from saving during COVID or whatever, and that they had been able to dip into those savings. And actually, you know, when we had Natalie Britton in here last year and she was talking about the cost of living crisis for her family, she had actually said at the time that her family were surviving off their savings. She had, if people remember that episode, had come back from Hollywood. They were living in LA, renting in LA, and they had come home to Ireland to try and settle here. And at the time, she was talking about the fact that existing and living in Ireland in terms of renting and groceries and everything, that they were relying a lot on their savings. So yesterday I asked people on Instagram to get in touch and tell us what exactly they're doing in terms of that cost of living sacrifice. And so many people came through and said that they are really, you know, cutting back on things that they used to have, you know. But I mean, it's things like, some people are talking about the fact they're cutting back on things like their mental health supports, like their therapy sessions, that they can't afford to go to therapy anymore. That they're
That's extremely common.
That's such a big part of people's sense of well-being and mental health. someone here saying, not being able to go to the doctor, I'm only taking my kids now. Someone saying, I'm no longer able to buy anything beyond hygiene products for myself. There just simply is no money. You know, a lot of people saying, actually, look, my independence is gone. I've had to move back home in my 30s and things like that. But I would say that the feedback that we're getting from people definitely echoes what we're seeing in that Bernardo's report. You know, and Richard, I would say, you know, some people might think that cost of living had leveled out and the government will say they've put supports in place. And we heard about the cost of living budget. But actually, the lived experience of people is quite different.
It is, yeah. And this is why, you know, despite the fact that, as the government would point to, inflation is slowing across the Eurozone at this point in time. Like, if you look at groceries, bills, they're still on an average level, they're at their highest level that they've been in the best part of two decades. And that's not just an Irish problem, that's a European and it's an international problem at this point in time. So there was a study which was done, which actually focused in on the vibe session thing last year by Amoric Research. I think Primark or Penny's was actually involved in that as well as one of the sponsors for it. 71% of adults eating out or getting takeaways less. Almost half of households cancelled an entertainment subscription, for example, Sky or Netflix, one of these sort of things as well. And almost two thirds of shoppers have switched to a more affordable grocery retailer. So going then towards the discounts, whereas they might have gone to, I don't know, Dunn's or Super Value in the past. So people are treating themselves less. People are very much scrimping and saving to try and turn this around as much as possible to try and get in control of their household savings. Now, there's a key problem with all of that, and this is where it comes into a, both a political and a societal issue, is that when you have governments at the top of it who are trying to point to the good economic indicators, and that happens here in Ireland, it also happens in the States, where Joe Biden is trying to get re-elected based on the strength of an economy which people don't see and feel. But then you have people like Gary Pilnick, who's a lad whose name I don't think any of... He's not a household name.
No,
but
not.
His products, which he sells, are very much a household product. He is the CEO of the Kellogg's Corporation. He was asked on CNBC the other day about how his company is dealing with the cost of living crisis. Here's what he had to say.
In general, the cereal category is a place that a lot of folks might come to because the price of a bowl of cereal with milk and with fruit is less than a dollar. So you can imagine why a consumer under pressure might find that to be a good place to go.
Right. I'm all for innovation and marketing, but the idea of having cereal for dinner, is there the potential for that to land the wrong way?
We don't think so. In fact, it's landing really well right now, Carl. When we look at all of our data, of course, we would know that breakfast cereal is the number one choice for in-home consumption. We understand that for breakfast. It turns out that over 25% of our consumption is outside the breakfast occasion. A lot of it's at dinner, and that occasion continues to grow, as well as the snacking occasion. But cereal for dinner is something that is probably more on trend now, and we would expect to continue as that consumer is under pressure.
That the grinning face there of Gary Pilnick, the CEO of WK Kellogg, cereal for dinner.
My producer was just saying that he gets $5 million a year, so it's well for him to...
Yeah, he's his base salary of $1 million per year and more than $4 million in incentives. So very tone-deaf approach, and even the fact that CNBC...
He's describing it as on-trend is the tone-deaf part
of it. That was grinning and dystopian sentence I think I've heard in the 2 years of this podcast, that cereal for dinner is a growing occasion. And it's something that we can see getting even bigger.
It's like the time your mom in the 90s was on the Special K diet and they were telling people to have Special K all day. I mean, look, I think it's totally, as you say, Richard, detached from the reality that people are dealing with at the moment. I just want to read you a few more of the comments that we got from people. One person who said, you know, I am lucky to be earning decent money, but things are so expensive. Things that were normal treats before are now a privilege. Privileges for me now include electricity and turning the heating on when I'm working from home during the day. Another girl said, I'm 30, I'm on €88,000 a year and I am living at home with my parents. Like, I can't find somewhere to rent. Again, a lot of this is rooted in housing, I would say, a lot of the feedback here. Someone else said, I'm living between my van, my mum's spare room and a mate's couch, 2 degrees, and rent is just far too high. Another person says, basically just paying bills with nothing else left afterwards. I am using my savings, but they won't last much longer, says another person. 26 years old and still at home with a full-time job and can only move to a house share at a very, very stretch. So, like, I think it's reflected. I think it's interesting, like, Michael McGrath was asked about this yesterday when he's going into cabinet, and he was saying that he's surprised that people haven't, you know, taken up the sort of cost of living measures that are in place by government. But like Bernardo's then would say as a counterpoint to that, that actually, you know, the way you have to go about applying for help, you know, the way every community has a local representative for
it's like a local welfare officer.
Yes, that's it. Local welfare officer, and you go to your local welfare officer and you fill in the paperwork and you, you know, outline your need. Like, these things are so slow, like everything. It takes ages. And, you know, like the point that Bernard is making yesterday is actually, you know, it's great to have the supports there, but they just need to be far more accessible. Like, you can't actually be in a situation where people are having to fill out reams and reams of paperwork and then finding out after the fact that they can't get access to what they need.
A question that immediately raises for me is like, what measures is he referring to? Like, is he talking about the renter's tax credit? Because, and we've discussed on this podcast before, the difficulty that some people have in trying to claim the renter's tax credit, because if it's a rent room situation or if their landlord is not registered with the RTB, then it's very difficult to actually access that. You can't just pop on the revenue website and try to claim it if you're if your tenancy isn't registered. So it's a really tricky thing to get to the bottom of. There's one other point that I think is worth making about all of this. We've heard a lot about inflation coming down and people expecting prices to come down. And that's kind of led by coverage about utility bills. You know, you see different energy providers engaged in something of a price war because the wholesale prices are coming down. When we talk about inflation coming down, what it means is that prices aren't rising as fast as they used to. Doesn't mean the prices are coming down.
Yeah.
And that's a point that I think a lot of people gloss over, that if inflation falls back to the 2% that everyone would like it to be, everyone thinks, oh, life goes back to being as affordable as it was in 2019 or 2020. But no, it means that the price rises of the last couple of years are now baked in, and you're hoping that social welfare allowances or your private sector wage help you catch up with that. But there's no guarantee they will.
Yeah, and there's that thing which some economists would point to as well, is when you have had the impact of inflation over the last number of years and the cost of living crisis, it becomes then like sort of trying to turn a ship around. That when you're, you know, seeing the slowing impact of inflation, you have baked in drop in living standards at this point in time because of the economic and the financial hit that everybody's taken into their pockets, households around the country. And to try and then improve and bring things back up takes a long time. So even as things are improving and household incomes are projected to rise this year, but still, because of that lagging impact of all of this, the suffering and the saving that people have had to do over the last multiple years, it's still going to take time before people feel that they're even back to that level that they were at before.
Yeah, another lady says, I'm a middle income earner. No new clothes for myself and my husband. We go without so that we can clothe our kids.
So you can clothe your kids.
So you can clothe your kids. Sit in the cold all day and only put the heat on when my son is at home and in the evening. Sorry, and eat cereal. Actually, sorry, I didn't see that one before. Now that's someone saying that they eat cereal in the evenings. You know, like, I think, like, the thing is, I think, as you said, Richard, household incomes are expected to rise, but then people aren't actually probably saving at the moment and they're relying on those savings. I think we're just going to end up finding ourselves caught in a bit of a pinch point towards the end of the year, which I think is going to be an enormous pressure for the upcoming budget this year, Gavin, in terms of how they're going to handle that.
And long story short, that's the budget that everyone expects to be the last big gambit before a general election. So if we're talking about don't go to the public in February because everyone is a bit broke and new taxes might have kicked in February, you know, there's a good argument that by the tail end of the year, if the budget doesn't immediately land for people, that their savings are already wearing so thin, that it could be very, very lean pickings by the time the country comes around to voting again. So we have to talk about RTE, but in truth, I don't know where to start about RTE, because it seems like last week, Richard, when we were here and we were talking about Kevin Backhurst maybe being dragged into it, or that he might have been the big bad bogeyman in Montrose 7 days ago. God, there's a lot of water going under the bridge since there, isn't there?
Yeah, and I feel like there's almost a risk that whenever we talk about RTE on a podcast that it becomes out of date within a matter of 24 hours. So expect that to happen with this podcast.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously the talking point this week has been, I mean, after Catherine Martin did a primetime interview last week on television, she had a primetime of sorts grilling this week in the Oireachtas Media Committee, which you were across last night, Gav. And I mean, I suppose the key question was really with regards to this meeting of the committee was whether or not she would do enough to sort of cover her own back in terms of projecting confidence in her ability to get to the bottom of the scandal. Do you think that she actually did enough in that regard?
Yes, in a weird way, because I think, long story short, I think after the marathon meetings on Tuesday night, there are now some questions for her or questions about her, but they are questions about it, kind of a slightly different thing to what they were when they were going in. So at the start of the meeting, everyone was like, why'd you go on television? Did you basically sack the chair on television? You know, why did you go about it in the way you did? And actually, the way in which Catherine Martin accounted for herself about the issues with Junior Alig's, you know, approaches and accounts to her in the last couple of days were quite robust. I mean, if you look at it, long story short, I mean, and we should say as a precursor, everyone has nice things to say about Junior Alig. She was a very, you know, well-minded person. No ill intent or no bad motives about accidentally misleading the minister. Everyone accepts that she was public service broadcasting to its core. But we do have a situation where the minister saw something in the papers the weekend before last, called Junior Alig in on Monday and said, is it true? Shun said no. She was speaking to her again on Wednesday and said, is it true? She said no. And then she had to ring up the department on Thursday morning to go, actually, I'd forgot, it is true. And I chaired that meeting where we signed off on Richard Collins' exit package, which does genuinely beg a question of confidence. And when the chair of RTE is the minister's go-to point person, the only interface between RTE and the government is this person, and you can't trust that they're always giving you the full story, then there is a genuine question of confidence. And that means that, you know, the minister rightly raising concern about that last week, even if she might have been over public, the substance of her doing that was right.
Yeah, and I think that's something. So obviously, Catherine Martin has attracted a huge amount of criticism since this controversy began 8 months ago at this point in time. But with regards to how she interacts with Shuni Rahilig, the chair of the RTE board, former now chair of the RTE board, I mean, there's been this isn't the first time this happened where there was a question in terms of information being passed on promptly and correctly from the chair of the board to the minister. There was, of course, even the situation around when Dee Forbes stepped down as the director general of RTE and whether or not this would be passed on. So, I mean, that is something which is key to the whole question mark around it. Now, there was a key revelation last night in terms of the order of how things transpired with regards to Shuni Rahilig, and that was how Shuni Rahilig responded to a potential letter being written by Catherine Martin, basically outlining her concerns about the misinformation as she saw it. So why does that timeline matter, and why is it significant?
The reason that matters is because it then raises the other questions for Catherine Martin about her own sense of political judgment or even her own antennae for seeing if there is a problem coming down the line. So Catherine Martin had apparently agreed as long ago as last Tuesday morning that she was going to go on primetime on Thursday night. And it wasn't with any new scandal or new development in mind. It was just a case of, I am the minister responsible for reforming the TV licence. We're coming towards the end of that progress and I want to talk about it. And that's apparently what it was. But of course, in the meantime, these disputes between Shuni Rahilig and, you know, whether she was giving the full picture or not comes up. Catherine Martin, having discovered that she had been misled and therefore, by the way, gone to a press conference last week where I and others were questioning her and she was repeating back things that Shuni Rahilig had told her, which weren't true. She wants to follow up on that. She wants to send Shuni Rahilig a letter. She wants to have a meeting. She wants to try and clear the air on all of this. The one thing that's worth stressing is that she said that she basically doesn't consider this to have been a resigning matter. That, yes, it was very mortifying, but that Shuni Rahilig was still, broadly speaking, the right person for the job, was doing really good reforms in RTE, and would rather she'd stayed there. And yet we have a situation where we now find out, as a result of last night's committee meeting, Shuni Rahilig was basically going to resign if she received a written scolding from Catherine
Martin. Why? Like, that's something I find hard to get my head around, is like, why was she so bet into the decisions? Like, well, look, you're going to write me a letter, or if you're going to ask for a meeting, I'm going to resign.
Do you think she was fatigued by the entire process at this point, though?
There actually was one little hint of that, because it's worth bearing in mind that the job of being chair of RTE is not a full-time role. It pays a stipend of 31,000 a year, so it's not considered to be anyone's full-time gig. You're supposed to be able to juggle other duties on the side. And Shuni Rahilig, having already been in with the minister twice that week, there was an implication from Catherine Martin's evidence that she really wasn't up for or couldn't make herself available to do it a third time. But nonetheless, you'd think, given the circumstances, there at least might have been the opportunity for a phone call or a Zoom call or just some kind of direct interaction between the minister and the chair.
Two meetings a week for 30 grand a year isn't like that unreasonable, is it? Like,
it's not really.
The scale of the controversy and the scandal, because the Irish Times over the weekend, they wrote about how current members of the board are, you know, upset and, you know, very downhearted at how this whole thing has transpired and the fact that Shun is no longer in the gig.
But like last Friday, there was even talk that they might have all walked out themselves.
But like, why so? Because it was her decision to walk out based on the fact that the minister was just going to write a letter saying that she was concerned about this. Like, she wasn't going to be forced marched out of the job. It's only when, it's all open to interpretation of facts. We also need to hear Shuni Rahilig's side of the story. But the fact is, from what the minister said last night, the minister didn't think that Shuni Rahilig had to go.
No.
At all.
It was mortifying, but it wasn't a resigning matter, basically.
Shun told her, I'm going to probably go if you write a letter writing out your concerns. And then
if you scold me in writing, I'm going to go. Catherine Martin said that basically she was hoping, these aren't her exact words, but she was effectively hoping that Shuni Rahilig might cool off a little bit, or that there was a certain level of frenzy to all of this, and that if she just took a moment or agreed to, you know, just hold your horses for a little bit and let's meet on Friday morning, maybe we can smooth all this over and that we'll realise that it's not the end of the world, basically. But nonetheless, the minister knows that Shuni Rahilig might resign if she gets a scolding in writing.
Okay.
And as push comes to shove later that day, she sends her one. And also, by the way, communicates to Sheena Riley saying, go on and tell you later this evening, there's a good chance this might come up, and if it comes up, I'm going to have to be honest. Which is almost effectively a coded way of saying, I'm going to have to dump on you in television. Which is very inconsistent with the idea that you're trying to smooth it all over and that you don't want her to walk out the door. And then what's more, and this is the really, really crucial bit, the story about Sheena Riley having accidentally misled Catherine Martin and all the others had not yet broken at that time. But apparently, as the minister was arriving out to Donnybrook to appear on primetime last week, her press officers start getting phone calls about it because some other media outlets have gotten wind of the story. And they reckon it's going to break shortly enough anyway. So apparently, as a courtesy to RTE, to Miriam McCallaghan and the primetime crew, the minister basically gives them the story, says, right, this is going to come out soon. And, you know, I don't want you guys to sort of feel like you're suddenly caught in the hop by someone else reporting a story breaking. So here I am giving you the story. And if you'd like to ask me about it, I'm open to that. Which, in anyone else's mind, would be handing them the stick with which to beat you
in
your own.
In many ways, actually, I think like it would be more prudent for them to try and get in and out without the production team having any copper idea of what was going on.
Yeah.
Obviously unfortunate for the production team, but you know, the idea of handing the story over is...
I think that the issue, there's an issue with Catherine Martin in that one of the biggest criticisms she's faced throughout the whole thing is that she hasn't been available for interview, that she hasn't been transparent. Mm. And if her digging in and saying, well, I can't back out of going on RTE now, is a question of transparency and being as open with the public about this, especially when the issue at hand is about misinformation, transparency and getting full facts out there.
I lied to the media on Monday, so now it turns out I better go clear the record. There's an argument for going ahead.
And if the story is going to be out there, possibly on the Indo website later on that evening.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's going to be a bit weird if she doesn't mention it at all or if it comes out afterwards, having sat through the interview on prime time. So I can sort of see it. And this isn't to absolve the minister for criticism, because there is a lot of criticism pointed at her and how she's handled this and how soft she has been at different times throughout it. So
I ask you both, just in terms of like, what does it actually mean bigger picture though? Because like, obviously this is about, you know, the back and forth between Sheen and the minister and all, but like, I suppose like ultimately if we're just to step back for a second and kind of look at what does it mean for the broader investigation into what's happening in RTE and where will we go from here? Like, what does it actually mean?
Well, I think that much has kind of run into the ground. So there's still a couple of more reports the government has commissioned about culture and governance. They're due back in the next couple of weeks. They're delayed as well, by a couple of weeks. That might lay the plate for the government to make final decisions about reform of the licence fee. But when you park the kind of the drama around Catherine Martin's own handling of this, then you're getting into the weeds. The other outstanding thing between the department and RTE is... And I appreciate these are very, really dense wording, by the way, and people are going to find this to be a really tedious way of summarising the story. But the row boils down to whether RTE adequately and clearly communicated to the government that the terms of reference for a subcommittee of the board dealing with the pay of senior presenters and senior management had been adequately communicated, and that the department therefore knew that the new role of directors included signing off on exit pay for senior executives.
How do you remember that? Like,
with great difficulty, because I've all been talking about it for 2 weeks, basically.
Right.
But that's how dense it is.
I think you've lost me.
So there's a good chance that even people have fallen asleep hearing that now in the last couple of minutes, which is why that bit has kind of run into the ground, which is then why we're left with a separate thing of like, well, does Catherine Martin know what she's doing, or how good is her political judgment? But the point is, it's a different story to the one we had this time yesterday.
Okay, where is Kevin Backhurst in all this?
That's the
man who's managing the crisis. Like, where is he?
Well, there is a question mark about him now, and this is something which people in the committee raised last night, and that they, I think it was about three people on the committee, said that they didn't have confidence in him as Director General, based on the fact that he was in meetings with Sheena Riley and Minister Catherine Martin, at which Sheena Riley passed on the information or misinformed the minister, so to speak, as the minister would put it, and didn't pipe up and say, well, actually, that's wrong or whatever, despite the fact that he's the man who is now leading the charge of reform. So it does, once again, as we sort of said last week, it calls into question this reform agenda and whether or not he is the guy to do it, because you have now had, on any basic level, the confidence in him, both within at a staff level in RTE, has been damaged by this, and then possibly more damaging at a government level, the confidence in him has definitely wavered a lot.
Yeah, it's definitely he's not wearing the same halo, I think, in government eyes that he had a couple of weeks ago, because now we mentioned last week that there was a certain level of connection between him and the exit deals for Rory Coveney and Richard Collins, which the government isn't wild about. And now if he was, you know, silent by a sin by omission in not speaking up at those meetings last week. For what it's worth, I did ask RTE about that earlier this week, because I put it to them that Kevin Backhurst sat beside the RTE chair and didn't pipe up to correct the record when the minister was being misinformed. And the gist of the statement I got back was that it was actually Kevin Backhurst who took the chair aside after those meetings and said, I think you've given her the wrong story there, and prompted Shuni Riley to go back and check the thing and therefore to change the record. So, or to hear saying, well, you know, he's not the interlocutor for the minister, but he was actually the one who got about setting the story straight afterwards. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, there is this now question, and it'll be interesting to see in the couple of days ahead whether that cloud still hangs over Kevin Backhurst or whether people just decide that they now need to let bygones be bygones and try to move on about the whole thing.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So have either of you ever heard of a drug called Lyrica?
Yes.
I haven't.
What do you know about it?
It's much like benzodiazepines and Zopaclones. It's one of a prescription drugs which causes a lot of alarm amongst people like the Anna Liffey Project and Merchants Key, for example, in that it's rife for addiction and for misuse and abuse. And it does often, you know, it's often used in conjunction with people who are addicted to heroin, for example, or people who use it and abuse it on its by itself. But it's all street names for just like, remember it used to be called Budweiser's because it gave people a very sort of a buzzy sort of drunken feel. But yeah, it's been an item of concern for a long time, but it's definitely back in the headlines at the moment.
So
it
is. Are we shorting, just to put it to very base terms, are we talking about a heavy duty painkiller?
Essentially, yeah, it is a heavy-duty painkiller that came into the Irish market back in 2004. So it's known as Lyrica. It's also called a coffin drug, they call it on the streets. And it's also known as pregabalin. So the reason it's back in the headlines is because toxicology reports over the last 10 years show that 1 in 16 toxicology reports, so 1 in 16 deaths that have had a post-mortem in Ireland have shown that pregabalin was present in the person's bloodstream.
Wow.
So, which is quite shocking. It is a very heavy-duty painkiller. That's what it was intended for when it came into the marketplace, I'd say, back in 2004. The types of things that you might be prescribed pregabalin for would include things like treating epilepsy, nerve pain, and in some cases, general anxiety disorders. So I suppose the thing about it is it's quite readily available. It's, you know, some people might even have it in their own cabinet and not even realise they have it. They might have been prescribed it a couple of years ago. Maybe they took it once or twice and they've just happened to have it at home. But coroners and doctors, particularly doctors who work in addiction services, are now calling for this to be a controlled drug, to be classified as a controlled drug because of that high level of prevalence. You know, we were speaking with Dr. Kieran Harkin, who works in Merchants Key, this week about it, and he had been telling us that, you know, he is seeing people coming in every single week who are severely addicted to pregabalin, Lyrica, whatever you want to call it, and that it's having a detrimental impact on people's lives. It's very dangerous in terms of, it's not a case that, you know, you can just come off it sort of cold turkey and decide to stop taking it tomorrow. You know, even to come off it in itself, there is a program to come off the this type of drug. But also, you know, the number of deaths linked to this now, as a 1 in 16 toxicology reports in the last 10 years showing the presence of pregabalin in the bloodstream. We were speaking with Alex Ormond. So Alex is in recovery herself for drug addiction, and she has been talking about pregabalin. And the reason she wanted to come forward and speak about this actually is because she has lost 2 friends to pregabalin use over the last 10 years at both ends of the decade. So one friend who died very sadly back in 2014, and another friend who died just last summer. And Alex actually found her friend dead in the bunk bed. Alex was sleeping on the top bunk and her friend was in the bottom bunk, and she found her friend dead one morning in August of last year, having taken pregabalin. And I just wanted you to take a listen. This is the moment she describes finding her friend dead in her bed.
And I knew that the girl was in the bed underneath me, and I just looked under, and she was sitting in the same position that she had been sitting in when I came into the room. And I didn't even go down the ladder. I just jumped off the top bunk and grabbed her. When I grabbed her, she was stiff. I put my hand on her forehead. It was ice cold. This is something I've gotten horrible nightmares about. I lifted her head and the whole middle of her face to here was black and the outside was blue and purple. So obviously rigor mortis had set in. Now, for whatever reason she was on them for, I don't know, but maybe she took an extra one and didn't think of the repercussions or the outcome, but she's passed away now, and I mean, that's two friends now I've lost, you know. And it's, people don't realise, yeah, you get this like superhero kind of a, you know, feeling from them, like you can take on the world, but you crash, and when you crash, you die, you know, or else you're at risk of death, you know. And they're so cheap and so easy to get, which is amazing. It's a disgrace.
So thank you so much to Alex, who came down to chat to us about that today. And she's minding her mum full time as a carer now. Alex is doing really well. But you know, she talks very openly about the fact that this being so available, you know, she said, you know, you could get it on the street tomorrow or today if you wanted it, that the accessibility factor is huge here. And I just want to take a quote here from Dr. Eleanor Fitzgerald, who I also spoke to, who's the president of the Coroner Society of Ireland. And she has said that the growing abuse of Lyrica could lead to it becoming the next OxyContin. And anyone who's watched that TV programme Dope Sick will know about OxyContin and the impact it's had on people's lives.
Yeah, I think that's one of the scary things about how it's being misused is the affordability of it in terms of street terms, and the fact that, I mean, you talk about the 1 in 16 toxicology reports that it's found in terms of people who have died in this country. If you actually count the amount of people who also have heroin or methadone in their system, it's up to a third almost, I think it is, in terms of they also have pregabalin or Lyrica in their system as well. So this is how much it's used in conjunction with things. And it does come at a time when there is concern about, particularly about overdoses we've seen since last year, both in Dublin and in Cork. I think it's nitazenes, isn't it? That there's almost a synthetic form of heroin which is out there at the moment as well. So in terms of opioids and in terms of painkillers and other prescription drugs misuse, there is a bit of concern out there at the street at the moment.
There is. Dr. Kieran Harkin said that they had contacted the Department of Health last year, doctors working in addiction services, and they had put forward an extensive case for it to be changed to a controlled substance. So they said they contacted the HPRA. The HPRA said this is a Department of Health issue, and the response they got back from the Department of Health was, we're monitoring the situation, which, you know, Kieran Harkin says just really isn't good enough.
That's basically what you say is you're holding response to anything if you have no actions up your sleeve. Yeah. Like, no, we're monitoring the situation. We might act at some point in the future.
Yeah, and Alex Ormond, when I put that to her today, I said, look, the Department of Health has said that they're monitoring it. You know, she found that quite upsetting, actually, to hear that, because she was like, what is there to monitor? You know, you can see now that 1 in 16 toxicology reports have pregabalin in it. You can see that people are dying, and, you know, you can see that there's a huge prevalence in Irish society. So what is there to monitor? There really needs to be some sort of action on it to make it a controlled substance.
Richard, will you be monitoring the forthcoming full-time vacancy at the FAI now that John O'Shea has been given only an interim appointment as the new man's boss?
Up the data is what I say to that.
Do you know, like, I think about the FAI, it's almost the Roman Empire.
It's the Roman Empire,
I think about it multiple times every day, both for League of Ireland reasons, for, you know, men's national team, women's national team, and all these other reasons. And one of the things which baffles me is that they didn't, as soon as Stephen Kenny was out of the job, appoint someone as an interim manager, because it would have covered up a lot of the just wildness of the last few months, where they've apparently been very close to appointing Lee Carsley. He didn't want the job. They've been very close to appointing Neil Lennon. Didn't want the job. Or that they didn't appoint Neil Lennon. Or that Chris Coleman was going to be immediately appointed. Didn't happen. So they've had all this back and forth about who the new permanent manager is going to be. And they've done the sensible thing at this point in time, because we're in no rush. We're not qualified for a World Cup or anything like that. Appoint John O'Shea as an interim measure. And that's at a time when there's a huge scrutiny on the FAI, which we'll talk about in a second. It's a good decision. It's a good decision.
People really like John O'Shea. Like, yeah, he's sound. People like him.
They do. There's a big, big, big constituency of Man United, Ireland fans. He'll be delighted to see a Champions League winner.
From a personality perspective, and I know nothing about soccer and never claimed to know much about soccer, but I think from a personality perspective, it's a good get.
Yeah, you probably came across him once or twice when you were down at
Basin Beach. Listen, and I tell you something, there's nothing more exciting when you're out in Waterford than John O'Shea being home for a weekend and being out in town and everyone going, John O'Shea's home for the weekend.
They used to say that during his time with Man United, that if you're in the Stretford end, that if you went down towards the tunnel and the players were going back in after their pre-match warm-up, if you shouted up Ferrybank, it was like some sort of secret code where basically he would stop and chat to you and stop for a picture in the way that others won't, because it's just that classic Irish thing of when you're on like Bondi Beach and you shout up Leash and all the Irish heads turn around.
I shouted at him outside Croke Park once. I was a kid. I don't know if he appreciated it, because it was obviously a big crowd of people. I was like, John O'Shea! I was a teenager at the time, so I'll excuse myself for that. But yeah, good appointment. There's a couple of friendlies coming up, which are going to be broadcast on Virgin Media Television. But it's a decent news story for the FAI at a time they badly need one, because they're very much under the spotlight again.
The only thing that I think is a bit of a shame, actually, is that given, as you said, we have no competitive games until the Nations League this coming autumn. When you're having friendlies, it's the point of friendlies not to allow a new manager to sort of tinker around with things. We aren't
in a position to appoint one, and we've been turned down by our main top target, Lee Carsley, unless he comes back again.
The question is, why have we been turned down so many times?
That's the thing. That's why we should have had an interim manager.
Is it because the FAI is so dysfunctional that apparently they have an internal culture where the CEO can jokingly say, wouldn't mind getting paid for my unpaid leave, and then lo and behold, it materialises a couple of weeks later. There's one man who would have been delighted to hear the scandal last Friday morning that Shuni Raleigh had resigned from RTE and that this was now the scandal occupying the airwaves. And that would be Jonathan Hill, the CEO, because the FAI didn't have a great time at the Oireachtas Media Committee last week.
Can I ask you, so if John O'Shea does interim manager, could he be made permanent eventually?
If he wins the friendlies. I don't think it's going to happen, but it could well do. That's happened before where interim managers become permanent managers.
Who was the best FAI manager, in your opinion, ever? Ireland manager ever?
Jack Charlton.
Okay, apart from Jack Charlton then.
I'd probably say Mick. Yeah.
Who's the best FAI chief executive in your lifetime? Because I think this is something which genuinely I thought was quite telling about this thing at the PAC last week. Sorry, it wasn't the media committee. It was PAC last week where Jonathan Hill, the chief executive, and other senior officials were in. Bear in mind, the FAI is in the middle of a government bailout right now. And one of the terms and conditions of that bailout is that the chief executive, the modern day successor to John Delaney, can only be paid the same and no more than the secretary general of a government department. The FAI managed to accidentally blunder through that in 2022, it seems, when Jonathan Hill was paid for annual leave that he hadn't been able to take. And in paying him for that unpaid leave, it ran him over the official limit of what he was allowed to earn, which then resulted in the FAI's funding being sort of temporarily put on ice while they tried to get to the bottom of it all. And it is worth just restating all of this because it's just so farcical. But it turns out that the apparent reason this all happened is that another junior member of staff was emailing senior management, Jonathan Hill being one of them, saying, due to unexpected circumstances, I wasn't able to take all of my leave last year. Is there any chance of being paid in lieu of taking the holidays? Other people all reply in the email chain and say yes. Jonathan Hill, although it's not his direct sign-off, says yes, no problem. And then makes what he describes as a throwaway remark of, wouldn't mind having an arrangement like that for myself,
We have to get direct quotes in these things. It's, can you negotiate the same for me, please, just in case the FAI come back at us, you know what I mean? So that's what he said, okay. That was it. But this is all.
Can you negotiate the same for me, please?
Yeah, exclamation point or whatever.
And lo and behold, then he gets paid $11,500.
Yeah, so the paying of over €11,000, which he's then paid back, of course, worth saying. But probably the most difficult point of all this for the FAI at a time, of course, as you say, of a state bailout, is the email chain and how that was produced to the committee. Because they want to see. Jonathan Hill's contention last year when this was first came out was that he didn't ask for this. He didn't ask for to be paid for holidays that you didn't take. So it's all being like, well, we'll need to see the emails here. But the emails they provided were completely redacted, which, again, we're talking about RTE and the FAI.
Transparency and whatnot.
Where they'd even redacted the name of the FAI on the email signatures. Like, the only thing that was left was the Twitter logo and the Facebook logo.
They redacted the time and date and all this. And all this was from the FAI's point of view. They said that they had legal advice because they wanted to protect the identity of the junior employee here. There's got to be a question mark about legal advice provided to people who are appearing before Oireachtas committees, because it does get in the way of transparency here, needlessly sometimes in terms of this. So they had no problem reading out the emails for the record and whatnot. But there is a big problem here in terms of when all of this came to light. I think Alan Dillon described it all as a cock and bull story about how this was all handled in terms of, oh, I didn't really ask for it and blah, blah, blah. It was a throwaway line in an email. There are serious questions once again about the man in charge of the FAI, and that is Jonathan Hill in this case. And of course, remember, he was appointed in the aftermath of John Delaney. And one of the, you mentioned, you know, the pay cap that is basically there. He can't be paid more than the Secretary General of a department. John Delaney at one point was paid €400,000 per year. And to try and make sure that there isn't that culture of excess in the FAI, that pay cap is there. But there also needs to be the scene. The FAI needs to be as clean can be. And there are good things happening in Irish football at this point in time. And it is unseemly. And it does go against that idea of the FAI is going in the right direction. When the president of the FAI, Paul Cook, at that committee says that, yeah, my confidence in the CEO has been shaken by this. So...
But
this isn't, it's not great. It's not great overall for the FAI, and it isn't gone away yet. I know the FAI, of course, obviously we have to try and appoint a permanent manager. They also have to get a permanent sponsor for the men's national team as well. So yeah, the FAI.
But we do wish you the best luck, John, with the new job. And we hope to see you on Waterford.
It'll be great.
And you look at his successes live and exclusive on Virgin Media Television next month. Not to go full old hairdresser, but have you seen anywhere nice booked for your holidays?
No, I have no holidays booked at the moment, actually. Have you? Oh, you're going to Rome, obviously.
Yep.
It's not a holiday. It's very much a...
kind of a working holiday.
I guess, yeah.
So you haven't got anywhere booked. Of course,
no,
you've got other things lined up for the summer.
Yeah, we've got things lined up for the summer at the moment.
Why is it that Ryanair are now warning that... Ryanair, who were complaining about passenger caps...
Do you have a holiday book?
...in Dublin Airport. We have. We're not taking a plane. Going on the boat to France again.
That's nice. You did that last year.
Worked out so well last year. Just why not do it again?
That's cute.
Kids just loved it. But Ryanair are warning that the price of a summer fare this year might be higher than otherwise expected because they were expecting to get more planes, Richard, and they ain't going to have them.
Yeah. So Ryanair is warning the fares are going to go up by as much as 10% this summer. So the consumer advice, if you want to take some consumer advice out of this, is if you're going to book your summer holiday, book it now.
Sooner.
Because A, there's a constriction in terms of the amount of planes that are available generally before this Boeing. So the Boeing thing is basically based on, you know, that thing that happened earlier on this year where the bit of the plane fell off.
Yeah.
Over, it was Alaskan Airlines, wasn't it? So because of that, there's an extra focus on Boeing and the amount of planes that they produce. Everything's going to be double and triple checked. So Ryanair,
good thing, surely.
Exactly, yeah. But Ryanair's just not going to have enough planes then to do what it wanted to do over the summer. So demand is up. They have a lower amount of airplanes than they thought they'd have. So prices are going up. So this actually has been a focus or a fact of life since the end of the pandemic traveling restrictions, is that there's been such a demand for holidays at a time when there are very few planes for airlines to actually buy, and now fewer and fewer and fewer. So now there's a real pinch on at the moment. 10% increase in fares there. And if you're thinking that, well, maybe by this time next year things will be better, there is such a backlog now in terms of getting planes onto the market.
That's a fair point, because of course Ryanair would be a very big buyer of planes, but they're not going to be the only people in the market trying to buy new fleet to try and add to the seats they've got available. So there's a good chance it'd be a backlog for a couple of years now.
Yeah, and the other knock on this as well is that there's a risk as well that some flights over the summer could be cancelled, as in flights which people would have already booked at this point in time.
Because they expected to have more planes that they now won't have.
Exactly. So yeah, this was a sort of a third or fourth headline story earlier on this week, but I think it's actually going to be something which might be, you know, quite a story when it comes to summertime.
Yeah, particularly because I suppose like I would be the kind of person who would definitely be a bit more of a last minute booking kind of person. And like, you know, I think people like me will probably be affected by this going through the summer. I think you're going to have to, given what's going on, I think you're going to have to be the kind of person who's a bit more organised about your holidays then and deciding what you're going to do a bit further in advance. You can get better deals. But yeah, I mean, I would generally be the kind of person who might decide within a 3 or 4 week window that I'd like to go take my holidays now and, you know, scrambling to get a flight sort of at a reasonable price.
And it's not as if, like, you know, Ryanair has obviously marketed itself as being the low fares airline for a long time. But I think, generally speaking, if you actually looked at the prices of flights since the end of the travel restrictions, they've all kind of gone up considerably anyway.
Yeah.
Like, Ryanair is lower than other places, and that's why it's going up by 10%. Other airlines are going to be up by like 5 or 6%. Mm-hmm. It's coming from a lower base.
But they're still dearer than they were 5 years
ago.
Yeah,
I think there's something like, there was a statistic that the airline fares are up by about 50% since the end of the pandemic anyway. Mm. Or based on, sorry, in comparison to pre-pandemic fares.
Yes.
They're up by 50% on it across the board. Yeah. So
lot of which might just be fuel anyway, because fuel has gone up so much here in the last couple of 5 years. Anyway.
And the way climate, you know, policy goes, this might be, you know, the age of really, really low cost travel on airways might be, I don't know.
I've never been like, you know, you hear these stories, people have get like a return flight for 20 euro kind of thing. Like, I've never been that person. Have you guys ever gone? I've never gone on that cheap.
I actually had to go for a job interview in Newcastle and the flights were 1 euro each way. And the booking the payment, like the credit card fee, it was with Ryanair. It was, I'm going to say it was spring 2009. I was coming out of college and there was a job going in a multinational who had originally applied for their Dublin office and they didn't have any work in Dublin. 2009, jobs were being created and then suddenly just removed everywhere. But they had other jobs going in another sister office in Britain and those jobs were in Newcastle. And I flew over for a day to do an interview. And the four of us that were living together all booked flights over for the day because they were so cheap. The fares for the four of us to go over and back were 8 euro collectively. Mm. But the booking fee, because it was credit card booking fees.
Like how
it was
a fiver airlines
per,
do that?
It was a fiver per flight. So the credit card payment fee was 40 euro, which was five times higher than the cost of actually taking the plane over and back to Newcastle for a day, which I thought was a little bit mad. But that is by far the cheapest plane ever.
Yeah, no, I've actually never, I hear about these stories, but I've never actually experienced it myself.
I think those days of those single figure, like less than 10 euro sort of thing, I think those days might be at an end now at this point.
If you can get cheap fares to any of Coventry Airport, Leicester, Sibsen Aerodrome, Silwell Aerodrome, Bedford Aerodrome, or Cranfield Airport, all of the aviation metropolises of the North East Midlands in Britain, you will be able to go stalking one of this year's fab film locations, Sarah.
Yeah, so what's happening with this? People are hanging around outside the Saltburn House.
Basically, loads of TikTok influencers have now overrun Drayton House, which is in Northamptonshire.
Northamptonshire.
Yes. Oh, well, I had to just make sure that I was remembering which one it was. The Grade 1 listed stately home called Drayton House has basically been mobbed by people who like the look of the place on Saltburn, basically, and have decided to go a little bit Barry Keoghan, not in that they're dancing around in the nip, but that they decided they'd quite like that, please, and go around for a bit of a poke, to the point where it seems that the manager thinks that the owner of the country mansion thinks the whole thing is a little bit weird.
And but have they opened it up to the public, or are they people just landing up there?
People are just showing up at the gates.
It's been described by the Daily Mail as the siege of Saltburn. All these people are going on and they're filming themselves dancing to like
Murder on the Dance Floor
or doing whatever. And also people have been posting online directions on how to get into the gaff, as in how to get off public footpaths into the grounds. Because again, stately home, it's private. It's private. So they're effectively in your garden. And this guy, Sackville, or whatever his name is,
titled man.
Charles Sackville.
Yes,
who
Mr.
lives
Sackville.
In Drayton House.
Yes. Probably not a mister, but he's a Sackville anyway. But he's basically said that he's like, how would you like it if you opened up your curtains one day and there was somebody filming a TikTok in your garden? Which I get. But this is what drives the social media economy these days is creating content. Mm. The thirst for content. And the thirst for content that does numbers is pushing people over the edge.
I just don't get why you didn't just open it up and make it a tourist attraction like they do with the Downton Abbey House.
It's an idea.
We have to live there as well.
Speaking of content, though, people will have to be content with that amount because we're completely out of time. Thanks to everyone for sending all your notes. That was a segue and a half. We have a new email address, thegroupchat@virginmedia.ie is how you can get in touch. If you want to send us your thoughts about cheap flights you've had, film sets that you'd like to go stalking, or your concerns about the cost of living crisis, do let us know. thegroupchat@virginmedia.ie. Until next time, thank you, Richard.
Thanks.
Thank you, Zara.
Thank you.
Thank you for watching. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.